We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
Backed by popular demand, the AFA Easter button is here. The bold new stained glass design features the cross at the center under the message, "He is risen." This beautiful design tells the story in one line. It's a conversation starter, so you might share the saving truth of Jesus' death and resurrection. A 10-pack of buttons is $15. 10 or more 10-packs are just $7 each. Order today at resources.afa.net. That's resources.afa.net. He is risen indeed.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Tuesday, March 11th, and the government is staring down a potential shutdown as the March 14th deadline looms. So the passing of the continuing resolution, according to House Republicans, even the Freedom Caucus, is of vital importance. And so the Freedom Caucus yesterday actually endorsed and approved that. So it seems like Representative Thomas Massie, who I adore, and I think he's amazing and a wonderful, principled conservative, it seems to be the only one on the Republican side not voting for it. So yesterday, President Trump put out a pretty scathing post against Massie and saying that he might try to primary Thomas Massie, who got a lot of support. Actually, Massie did on social media, and a lot of even Trump supporters are saying, no, we love Massie. We need more Massies. And I agree with that. I actually posted on X that we need more Massies, less rhinos. But the passing of the CR, at least according to Republicans, and this coming from PJ Media, as we approach the March 14th deadline to fund the government, Democrats are playing their favorite game, manufacturing a crisis to force through their bloated spending agenda while Republican leadership works tirelessly to pass a sensible continuing resolution, or CR, that would freeze spending and secure our southern border. Democrats are deliberately orchestrating a shutdown. Their endgame? Protecting their precious slush funds and derailing President Trump's America First agenda. And of course, stopping the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, dead in its tracks. And Senator Mark Wayne Mullen talked about that last week, and talking about how some of the GOP budget should really be titled the DOGE Act, because that's what Republicans are aiming for. This is what he posted on X.
We're getting a lot of questions about what's the difference between the House budget that they voted on last night, reconciliation budget package, whatever you want to call it, or the Senate version that we passed last week that was, you know, the all-night vote-a-rama. By the way, these, because some people are calling it budget, some people are calling it reconciliation, why don't we just call it the DOGE Act? Because really this is about President Trump's agenda, about pushing forth his agenda, making the cuts, getting us healthy, making sure our defense is strong, making sure our economy is strong, making sure our energy sector is strong, making sure our military is strong, and then locking in taxes. So what's the differences between the two? The one we voted on in the Senate last week is just a very narrow package. It just dealt with defense, national security, and the border with energy in it. What the House passed was a much broader package, and it also included taxes. Now, the current tax policy, we're just looking to extend it. The problem is this only extends it for up to 8 years. The president, if you're paying attention today, just put out a Truth Social post that him and I spoke about earlier today about asking the House and the Senate to make them permanent. And I will tell you, I don't want to see these expire. And that's exactly what we're facing right now. If we don't do something, they're going to expire. Why play games with it? As a business owner, as investors, or even for your personal finances, having a surety on where your tax rates is going to be and locking in the tax cut that President Trump put in place in 2017 is what we need to be doing, not simply just kicking the can down the road, but make it permanent. So what's going to happen now, the House version is going to come over to the Senate. We're going to amend it. We're going to try to make the tax, well, we're going to make the tax policy permanent, and then we'll send it back to the House, and then they'll vote on it.
So that's what happened, is it sent back to the House. And Town Hall Media, Hugh Hewitt said this: do not let the government shut down. Keep the deportations going. Keep the defense buildup rolling. Keep the Doge dozing. Get it done. Pass the CR. So let's welcome in Tho Bishop, who is the director of communications at the Mises Institute. Tho, so where are we at? Because, you know, a lot of conservatives are very concerned, I think, and perhaps rightly so. As my colleague and good friend Abraham Hamilton III put it this way: how are we both dozing with trying to cut the bloat of the federal government, but also seem to be diving with doing this kind of what seems like a massive spending package, at least according to people like Massey?
Yeah, well, I mean, the reality is that a lot of this is pure theater. And so you're going to have senators, you're going to have the majority of the Republican caucus in the House talk about how much, golly gosh darn, they just love Elon Musk and how much they love Doge, and try to use that branding to ignore the fact that these are completely unserious spending bills, because Congress doesn't work when it comes to reducing spending. That's the bottom line. That's the entire reason why Doge is so necessary to begin with, is that the incentive structure for your average member of Congress, no matter what they claim to believe in, is to try to protect the bacon for their in-house districts. And so I think it's like the CR bill, for example, the spending cuts that are being celebrated right now, I think it comes down to like a net cut of about $6 billion between increases in defense spending and cuts to non-defense spending, which is well, well below what Doge has itself identified. So a lot of the ridiculous USAID spending, things like that. I mean, a lot of the most egregious examples would be further codified in this kick the can down the road spending package. And so that's, unfortunately, that's what Washington looks like. And, you know, outside of the energy that we have seen from the Trump administration and the outside efforts of Doge, you know, Republicans in Congress are going to continue to act like Republicans in Congress.
And that apparently includes the House Freedom Caucus, because the HFC official position in their press release late yesterday said that the 6-month spending freeze continuing resolution they support that. So the fiscal year 2025 continuing resolution. So they say this: contrary to Congress's longtime abuse of this legislative tool, this CR is a paradigm shift. Is that maybe going a little too far to call it a paradigm shift?
Yeah, absolutely. And I understand, like, again, if you're the House Freedom Caucus, you're in a tough situation, because you've got two outcomes here. One is that you can accept what you're getting with this CR, or you force Johnson to have to make a deal with the Democrats, which is going to end up with the worst piece of legislation. But it's not a paradigm shift. I mean, right, fast forward to way, way, way back to the end of 2024, right, when they were identifying that a lot of the frustrations that Chip Roy and the Thomas Massey of the world were the fact that, you know, that whole traditional budget process, right, of passing, you know, individualized bills for different appropriations, right, the whole reason why Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House in the first place, the whole reason Kevin McCarthy was fired, way, way back in that ancient history, was because we don't handle the appropriations process in a serious, thoughtful way, and that's exactly what we got here. So what paradigm shift is here? I mean, maybe the fact that you save a penny, you know, more than you have in the past, maybe that's a paradigm shift. I'll take it. Again, it is better than what you'd have gotten if the Freedom Caucus did not sign on board, right, because you would have had to work with Democrats. So again, I have sympathy for some of those members that actually do care about this sort of stuff. I'm going to deal with those two different trade-offs here. But the much more fundamental thing is that the majority of the Republican caucus is just not going to be serious about this sort of stuff. And that is the real threat here And because we have the most pressure that we've ever seen from executive branch on a spending issue. And this is, you know, these are the results we're getting right now.
And I'm speaking with Tho Bishop, who is the director of communications at the Mises Institute. You can follow him on X. And so where would this go from here? I mean, if this is likely going to pass and we'll have this CR and then Doge will continue doging. So when you have kind of these two really competing interests with then the majority of Republicans in Congress and the Senate suggesting they want all these spending cuts, but then not, you know, really putting the weight of their power of the purse strings behind it, how much can Doge really accomplish?
You know, I think it's the continuing campaign of highlighting what all are in these, you know, what is all the grift within the regime that has been there for so long that people don't think about it, shaming politicians into doing their jobs, and then, you know, hopefully get to the point where there's enough pressure building up here. But I mean, the problem is that it's you know, on that issue, on the spending issue, I'm not particularly optimistic about the realistic outcomes, because I think that the energy that we've seen from Doge's efforts has far exceeded anything that I thought was possible going into this administration. I think they've done a great job on a number of fronts there. And still we're in this situation. So how does that look like? What levers are needed? I've always kind of thought that if I were in the Trump administration, I would recommend calling for a national emergency over the government spending, because that's truly what it is, and we need it to be treated like that beyond Sunday morning talking show talking points. So how this process looks going forward, I mean, it's important right now to kind of kick the can down the road to not have to deal with the shutdown consequences, because the most important thing in many ways is to keep the Trump's momentum going at this part. And there's other factors out there that are creating kind of the first little headwinds against the administration after all the energy that we've seen. So the stock market situation's not going right. They're not going great right now. There's some bubbling concerns about tariffs and things like that. Getting this, the biggest advantage of this particular bill is getting the concerns about a government shutdown, which personally I don't particularly mind. I mean, shut it all down as far as I'm concerned, but it never really works out politically for Republicans. Try to give a little more runway. And I don't know if the administration continues to take a more aggressive, harder line on the spending side of things, or ultimately push comes to shove next time it comes to the true budget cycle, when you're dealing with the much larger appropriations process, when you're dealing with the tax cuts and things like that, if the stick is once again going to come out to those saying that we're not cutting enough, like what we've seen with Thomas Massie in the last 12 hours, or if or is that the opportunity where, with a more robust, comprehensive package, that's something more tangible in terms of the spending side of things that are going to be addressed. So we'll see. I'm not particularly optimistic about this, though.
Yeah, and you mentioned, Tho Bishop, the tariff situation, and in NBC's Morning Rundown just an hour ago, this was the headline: stocks tumble after Trump imposes tariffs. Trump and the White House downplayed a dip in the stock market after the president imposed new tariffs on Canada and Mexico. And so yesterday, the S&P 500 had its worst day since September, wiping out all of President Donald Trump's post-election gains. Meanwhile, the NASDAQ had its biggest one-day drop since 2022, plunging deeper into quote-unquote correction territory as the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped by roughly 2.1%. So let's talk about tariffs and where the conservative position truly is, because obviously Trump is using this as a tool. It doesn't look like he's backing down from imposing this. And he calls it reciprocal, and he's saying, if we're paying tariffs, then these other countries need to be paying us as well. And then he thinks that we'll kind of average out and everything will go down. So what should be the conservative view on tariffs?
Well, trade first and foremost is a good thing. It's a very important thing, and that cannot be ignored. And Trump plays this particularly interesting game where, on one side, he talks about how tariffs are going to make us rich, we're going to replace the income tax with tariffs, all this sort of stuff, explicitly pro-tariff. But then when you kind of look under the hood, right, you know, he loves making trade deals. You know, his entire truth post about reciprocal tariffs was itself sort of a way of telling other countries they need to reduce their trade burden with us as a way for us to reduce our trade burden with them in this dynamic. He's talking about having free trade deals with Argentina. And so in many ways, you know, he doesn't fit the box of either being a traditional, free market, free trade guy, nor truly a protectionist. It's more kind of an economic policy designed out of addressing the perception of us being ripped off. And I think in some cases that's very, very correct. I'm not going to say in all cases identified here. I mean, I've got plenty of complaints about Canada, but there's important. Fertilizer, particulars, those important resources we get from up there in the north. So there's a level of nuance, particularly since Trump likes to use it not necessarily as an economic tool, but more as sort of a foreign policy diplomatic tool, which is a very interesting approach to that dynamic. Of course, the other side of it is that this entire concept of this golden age of free trade is that we've had plenty of government intervention within those this golden age too. So some people that are attacking Trump on this issue kind of I think get that history wrong as well. But whatever it is, it is disruption from the kind of longstanding policies, and so it's not surprising to see the stock market, for example, not particularly like disruption because it usually doesn't matter what that. Policy is a change from the norm gets people to freak out, and of course you add to that the fund dynamic is that if you do any reduction that you do get of government spending is going to address GDP issues and things like that, and that's going to respond to the market and things like that. So one of the downsides of a presidency that is disruptive is the stock market is not always going to particularly like that, and I think that's what you're seeing right now.
Mm. Yeah, well said. I mean, Trump's middle name is divisive, pretty much. I mean, that just is an apt description. And so, he's changing everything. And I think that's the point, and that's part of the mandate in Washington. And so the predictability that the market stability likes, and of course the establishment in Washington likes, they want things to go along with the status quo. When Trump represents so much disruption, then we're going to have some of these differences. And so, of course, the left is going to take advantage of a lot of these headlines to suggest, oh, well, we shouldn't be doing things the way that Trump wants to. Let's go back to the old establishment way. But do you think that this will overall even out if we get DOGE to the point that we are actually reducing a lot of government spending and tariffs work in the manner that Trump wants, and ultimately disruption, while maybe uncomfortable in the short term, will get us eventually where we want to be in the next 2 to 4 years?
Well, I've been very impressed with some of the benchmarks that Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, has specifically stated, right? I mean, one of the explicit goals is decreasing the size of the government spending aspect of GDP as itself a measure. That plays a big role in particular, with a particular focus on the employment side of things and the role that, a lot of the job gains that we saw for the last several years with the Biden administration, right? Most of those were government jobs, and there was much better in the productive side of things. So when I hear Bessent identify different sort of benchmarks for the way that he sees success, I think he gets a lot of big picture things a lot more right than people that we usually see in that position. It's a very difficult, and this is a very difficult task, right? Trying to get Congress and to get the government to actually reduce spending, which it hasn't been able to do for quite some time, able to strong arm other countries that don't like a strong American president to get better trade deals, to be able to attract the sort of international investment here to deal with the regulatory administrative state. I think he has had success in some of those areas in the past, his first time around. This is a much bigger mandate. This is a much bigger challenge. I mean, one of the challenges he had is that he inherited a much, much worse economy than he did last time around, and the specter of inflation is still very much out there. So, you know, I think that he has a much better team. I like a lot of what I hear in terms of how they measure the success themselves. But it's going to be a, you know, there's not an easy, these are very serious problems, and there's not very easy solutions. And so I think that this is the best chance we've had in quite some time. It's a complicated puzzle to figure out. So the outcomes ultimately are going to, it's not something that can be measured in the short term disruption, stock markets, things like that. It's something that will be able to truly measure the effectiveness of this action in the next year, 2 years, 3 years. And I think that's something that's important to keep in mind. We'll see how voters are willing to give that sort of grace, but it's something that I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. But what is better might be the biggest shift that we've seen on a lot of these very systemic problems in quite some time.
Well, well said. Well, Tho Bishop, really appreciate your time this morning and commentary, Director of Communications at the Mises Institute. And we'll take a break here for my producers, and we will come back with more. But I think that the American people and the voters especially who gave Trump this mandate are willing to extend that kind of grace. I don't think that the kind of fear-mongering of the legacy media headlines are quite as persuasive as they used to be. And probably for the everyone who's giving Trump the high approval rating, say go, go, go on Doge, is willing to say, okay, let's wait and see. Because obviously under Biden, it was really bad with no plan to get better. So even if there's disruption for the short term, at least as far as I'm concerned as an American voter, I'm willing to kind of go through the disruption to see the better outcome on the other side. All right. Well, we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And the left is having a complete and total meltdown over Trump's plan to abolish the Department of Education. And it's kind of glorious to see, by the way, because for so long, the teachers unions and the left have been so entrenched in the way that everything was. I mean, we talked about disruption in the last segment. I mean, this is a huge part of Trump's mandate and how the administration is pushing forward with disruption to actually, as much as they can, abolish the Department of Education, return the subject matter and funding, all of that back to the states and to parents, to individual students and parents and families who rightly should have the resources and the funding that follows each student, not the government's selected schools and the government-funded schools, to choose for themselves their best plan for education. I mean, that is a right that parents have, and that we as individuals with freedom and liberty and God-given rights in this country should have. And financial finances should not be in the way of that when the government is only providing one specific pathway or incentivizing, basically, for publicly funded institutions rather than students to do what is in their own best interest for education. I mean, this is where, do you want indoctrination or do you want merit-based? Because students who learn more and learn better will ultimately contribute more to the workforce. But of course, that's not what the left is all about. So Randy Weingarten, who is, of course, like the poster child of liberal meltdown this week, had a total meltdown on MSNBC. And this was just one of several clips. But here is how she is just squawking and is so very mad about taking away funding from public schools. This is cut three.
This is why so many people are so mad about it, because they're just taking opportunity away from kids that don't have it. So billionaires, kids of billionaires, they have it. They go to private schools. Everyone else, 90%, go to public schools. Don't take away their opportunity.
So let's stay on the facts.
Sorry.
No,
I'm really angry about this.
No, because this
I'm
is
really
what
angry.
Need to hear.
I taught kids in Clara Barton High School in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, yeah, no, don't stay on the facts. Don't apologize for just, you know, ranting and going off, totally off base on the facts. But, you know, that's MSNBC. But also, Randy Weingarten also said that she knows that states will use education dollars for vouchers and, you know, other things. And so, obviously, this is more about taking away the – funding for publicly funded institutions and indoctrination camps and teachers unions and all of those incentives, rather than providing actually a great education and choice for students. But listen to more of Randy Weingarten. This is the last one, I promise, because it's hard to listen to her squawking unless you're just laughing like I am. But this is cut two.
Equally pernicious, they're saying, oh, don't worry, let's block grant it. So we'll give it to a state education department. Right. So, and then let the state education department decide what to do. So we know, for example, what Texas would do.
Right.
They'll use it for vouchers. So they won't give it to the kids who have it now. They'll just give it for vouchers.
Catholic schools, religious schools.
Oh, the horrors. Well, let's welcome in Corey DeAngelis, who is one of the best school choice advocates in the country. He's also an author and a senior fellow at the American Culture Project. And Corey, you posted both of these clips, and I think we're laughing probably even harder than I was about this. But I mean, what's the problem here with actually with dollars actually following students rather than state funded institutions?
Well, I'm glad she said the quiet part out loud and revealed why she's actually concerned about the Department of Education going away. It's not because kids are going to be less educated. It's because she knows her power is slipping away from her fingertips. She's no longer going to be able to have a monopoly on the minds of other people's children. Oh, guess what? Oh, the horror. Some states might choose to give that money back to the parents to raise their own kids in the way that they see fit. So Randy Weingarten said she's angry. I think she's more afraid than anything else. But why wasn't she angry about the schools being closed for a couple of years in union-dominated districts that hurt kids academically, mentally, and physically? Why wasn't she angry about the decades of learning loss caused by those closures? Why wasn't she angry about the 35% chronic absenteeism rate in places like New York City? Why is she angry about 40% of kids having of the Baltimore high schools having 0% math proficiency rates? The thing is, this is great news. If Randy Weingarten's upset, I think it means something great is happening in education. That means she's afraid her control is slipping. And the good news is we already are making a lot of momentum in red states. We've had 15 red states pass universal school choice in the past 4 years alone. And I'm in Texas right now in Austin. And today we have a House Education Committee hearing on a universal school choice bill. One already passed our Senate, and we have 76 co-sponsors in the House, which is just enough votes to make it pass this chamber as well. So it looks like Texas will be number 16 on the states with universal school choice. And it's Randy Weingarten's own fault. She fought to close the school. She showed parents through Zoom school what was happening in the classroom. And conservatives, independents alike, they were upset. They didn't want indoctrination. They didn't want radical left and activism in the schools. They wanted just the math, reading and writing. They wanted the basics. And so parents made their voices heard, and politicians are finally listening to them in the red state laboratories of democracy. Hopefully the blue states will come along too, but the red states are making the first move, and competition's a rising tide that lifts all boats. Public schools are going to get better. The kids are going to have more opportunities, and parents are going to be able to raise their own children. It's a glorious day to be an American.
Amen to that. I'm speaking with Corey DeAngelis, an author and senior fellow at the American Culture Project. And if you are in Texas today, you can call your representatives and make your voice heard and let them know that you support this, if you do, and you support school choice. And isn't this always, Corey, the leftist position that they know better than parents? They don't trust parents with their own children. I mean, this goes right along with Hillary Clinton's whole thing that, you know, children belong to the village. It's a community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Biden and Kamala even saying out loud that children belong to the state rather than, as we know, not only from the rights that are protected by our U.S. Constitution, that obviously the training, welfare, education, decision making, all of those things are specifically given to parents. But that also follows the biblical worldview that God gives children to parents. So we have this very drastically bifurcated worldview. But it comes down, I think, to the fact that the left always wants to make the decisions for you rather than having the individual, for ourselves or for our kids, make our own decisions and exercise their own freedoms and liberties. I mean, that's ultimately what I think the school choice debate comes down to.
Yeah, they think they know better than parents. They think they own your kids. You look at Becky Pringle. She's the other union boss of the largest teachers union, the NEA. I just posted a video of her where she says, this is for our babies. No, they're not your babies. They may be your students for part of the day, but they're not your children. And you had Terry McAuliffe in Virginia lost an election over this when he said, I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. A Democrat lost to a Republican on the issue of education. Glenn Youngkin was victorious. And I think Republicans, if they lean into this issue, they're going to win more elections. Trump was the leader on the issue of education against Kamala Harris, according to Atlas Intel polling on two occasions. And he won the parent vote by 9 points, according to exit polling back in November. So Trump is showing the American people why he won that. He ran on the issues of school choice. He ran on abolishing the Department of Education. I hope Linda McMahon gets in there, and she was confirmed on a 51-45 party line vote. I hope she can get in there and body slam that unconstitutional department once and for all. The thing is, we need enough votes to overcome a filibuster. You need a three-fifths majority, 60 votes in the Senate. I don't think Democrats are going to come along based on their vote against Protecting Women and Girls in Sports Act. They all voted against it. And so we didn't have enough votes to invoke cloture to stop the filibuster for that bill. Hopefully That's Democrats insane. Lose some elections over this radical stance that they're taking on all of these issues in the midterms in 2026. So, you know, at some point they're going to go so far and run so far left, they're going to lose more seats on the issue. Maybe then, if we can't kill the Department of Education overall in one fell swoop, maybe Linda can get in there and give it death by a thousand cuts and kill it from the inside. I think that might be the plan. I think that's why Randy Weingarten's so upset right now that people are going to be able to raise their own children. And guess what happens when families can choose a school for their kid? They're going to be less likely to be indoctrinated with socialist ideology, and you're going to have fewer Democrat voters being churned out of the government school system. And I think that's the bigger play here. The Democrats know they don't even have to have their own kids. If they have the public schools, they can use those for 13 years of children's lives to mold their minds to vote for more big government policies. I think school choice hits at the root of the issue and helps parents reclaim their children's education.
Amen. Well, thanks so much for the work that you are doing. You can follow Corey DeAngelis at DeAngelisCorey on X. And if you're in Texas, call your legislators today, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And one of the best conservative warriors in the country, in my humble opinion, is making a lot of headway for conservative wins. And that'd be none other than Attorney General Andrew Bailey out of the great state of Missouri. And a couple of headlines that are both really huge. First, the Attorney General has secured an historic $24 billion judgment against China for unleashing the COVID-19 pandemic. So this was last week that That judgment was secured six times more than the previous largest judgment in Missouri history. He said this is a landmark victory for Missouri and the United States. If China refuses to show up, that doesn't mean that they'll get away with causing untold suffering and economic devastation. We intend to collect every penny by seizing China-owned assets, including Missouri farmland, which I think is such a brilliant plan to actually take back our land that is being sold off very irresponsibly to China. And then the second headline is this breaking back last week as well, that the Attorney General is demanding that the DOJ investigate whether President Biden's cognitive decline allowed unelected staff to push through radical policy without his knowing approval. If true, according to AG Bailey, these executive orders, pardons, and all other actions are unconstitutional and legally void. Fascinating. So let's welcome in AG Andrew Bailey himself. So good morning, sir. And, you know, this is all just so epic. So on these two headlines, where do you want to start?
Well, first of all, good morning, Jenna. Thank you so much for having me on and covering these stories. You know, I think the China story is really interesting. This is a groundbreaking piece of litigation. Missourians are still demanding justice for the harms inflicted during COVID-19, and we can point directly towards the Chinese Communist government as perpetrating this pandemic on the world. They created the virus, unleashed it on the world, suppressed evidence. The world needed to respond to the virus, and then created medical equipment and then hoarded that medical equipment instead of supplying it in the open market exchange to states like Missouri that harmed Missouri. And look, this isn't some crackpot legal theory. In 1976, the Congress passed and the president signed into law the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. It is the basis of our claim, and it creates the vehicle by which states can redress grievances against foreign governments. China does business in the United States. They had to know they were subject to the laws of the United States of America. They were served notice of this litigation and provided an opportunity to be heard and offer mitigating evidence or defense, but they couldn't be bothered to show up. That's how little they think of these United States of America. I am proud to have gone to court, delivered the win, and we're going to start collecting on that $24 billion that the Chinese Communist government owes to the people of the state of Missouri for the wrongs inflicted during COVID.
This is incredible. And like I said in the opening, I think that going out and seizing their assets, including farmland, is a really good way to go. I mean, does this also pave the way for other states to follow suit? I mean, literally, like, file their own suits, because obviously China's actions would have affected all of the 50 states. And so this is creating, in a sense, that precedent.
Yeah, I think that's right, Jenna. I mean, this is a blueprint for other states to follow. And look, if we band together and all fight to hold China accountable, it'll start to make a difference. $24 billion is a lot of money to the people of the state of Missouri. It's probably not a lot of money to the nation of China. But if you get New York, California, Texas, other state, Pennsylvania, other more populated states whose harms, the harms they suffered were greater because they have larger populations, then you cobble together multiple judgments, that starts to make a real impact.
Yeah, and so where then is the incentive for China to respond? I mean, if there are more of these lawsuits, would that create more of an incentive for them to come and actually start somehow providing some mitigation, which probably they can't, honestly, but I mean, they could at least make the arguments. But it seems, as you mentioned, just utterly disrespectful to not only the process, but the obvious ability that, you know, that the United States can bring them into court and to make them face their actions. It just seems very irresponsible that they wouldn't even show up and even respond.
I think you're spot on. I think that, you know, if Americans are doing business in China, certainly we anticipate that we'll be subject to the laws and the judicial processes in China, as rigged as they may be under a communist dictatorship. At least here they had a free, fair, and open shot at defending themselves. But again, I think it speaks to their level of culpability. And everything we've learned since the president was elected reiterates these points and emphasizes these points. Since the CIA documents were declassified, proving that the intelligence community now even believes that the pandemic originated in a lab in China, and the lab leak theory is now the predominant source of information for, you know, explaining how the pandemic was unleashed in the world. That again, that just emphasizes Chinese culpability. And I think that's exemplified by their refusal to participate, their lack of evidence, and their inability to offer anything, even a scintilla of evidence and mitigation.
And I'm speaking with Attorney General Andrew Bailey from the great state of Missouri. So what are the next steps in terms of starting to seize these assets? I mean, I'm a huge fan of saying, let's take back our land from the Chinese Communist Party. I think it was absolutely ridiculous that we've even sold any of it to any foreign nation or foreign holders. But could this also affect any Chinese nationalists that, or is this just land that would be owned by the government of China?
Well, it's any assets that we can prove are owned by the Chinese Communist government, and we have to be able to go to court, demonstrate that in court, and then get a court order to seize the assets, have them sold in order to make good on that $24 billion judgment. So it's going to take time to identify the assets. But I would point out, too, that in other litigation across the country, the way that the Chinese Communist government has camouflaged or deceived the public about the line of ownership of their assets in the United States of America is really crafty and clever, and we're going to have to penetrate through that. In other words, if Xi Jinping serves on the board of directors of a Chinese company, that is not a privately owned entity, because, of course, the rest of the board of directors are going to vote the way that Xi Jinping wants. It's called the golden ticket or the golden vote. And so it's just a facade to make it look like a privately owned asset when, in reality, the Chinese Communist government exerts total and complete control over that. And so those are issues that we're going to have to litigate.
Well, I'm really glad that you are the champion that is stepping up to litigate these on behalf of Missouri. But I think as a blueprint, as you mentioned, for the rest of the states to follow. And so let's turn to second story, demanding the DOJ investigate whether Biden's cognitive decline allowed unelected staff to push through radical policy without his knowing approval, and that the executive orders, pardons, and all other actions are unconstitutional and legally void. You mentioned in your letter to the Office of the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, that the states need to know because the orders affect us. And I think that is absolutely spot on. And so have they responded yet to this demand?
No, the Inspector General has not, and nor do I anticipate him to. As you know, several of the rules and regulations governing the work that the Inspector General does requires him to keep that work and those investigations confidential, so we may not know for some amount of time. This was more an issue of putting this on the radar and beginning to have the conversation to try to demand transparency and to establish the fact that we're talking about a fraud perpetrated on the American people of constitutional proportion. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, claims like this are raised in probate courts across the United States of America to challenge testamentary instruments like a will. If somebody signs a will prior to their demise dispersing assets and they weren't of right mind when they signed it, then the person that missed out on those assets can challenge that the signature on that document. And it's the same thing here, except it's worse because we're not talking about the dispersion of assets. We're talking about the exercise of constitutional authority that under Article 2 is vested in a singular president of the United States. So if Joe Biden wasn't signing the documents, didn't know what he was signing, didn't understand the implications, who was running the government? Those people need to be identified and held accountable. And it calls into question the legal validity of all of the documents that President Biden signed.
Yeah, and this could have wide sweeping ramifications if that is proven. And I think the left is almost helping you a little bit in that with some people like Jake Tapper's new book that's suggesting that they knew and this was a fraud perpetrated on the American people. And somehow, you know, the legacy media wasn't a part of that. And, oh, wow, we're just discovering this now, which I think is hilarious. But there are some journalists or reporters or, you know, the biased media, but some that are even helping prove this point. So where would an investigation go? I mean, if you're the Inspector General or you're of the U.S. DOJ, what would be your next steps in moving this forward?
Well, again, I think we've got to pinpoint who was making the decisions, what conversations were had with Joe Biden during his cognitive decline. And as you point out, there's an increasing quantum of evidence to corroborate the notion that he was not of sound mind. I mean, shoot, his own Department of Justice in February of 2024 said he didn't have the mental acuity to form the requisite mental state of an intentional act. Well, if he can't form the requisite mental state for an intentional act, who then was putting legal documents in front of him for his signature or auto-pinning those on his behalf, as the Heritage Foundation pointed out? And so I think those individuals need to be identified. They need to be interviewed and on the record state what observations they made. We know that Speaker Mike Johnson had conversations with the president in 2024 where he accused the president of signing executive orders that harmed U.S. energy, and the president didn't know anything about it, claimed he hadn't done it. And so, you know, all of this evidence put together leads to the conclusion that these documents are not legally valid, and that's a determination a court ultimately will have to make. But again, I think the inspector general conducting an investigation into the individuals who are pulling the levers of power on the president's behalf, exposing them, getting them on the record, and developing this evidence so we have a more clear picture of which documents are invalid and which aren't, I think that is going to assist the states in crafting a legal path forward.
And I'm speaking with Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey. And this is a fascinating constitutional question as well, because at least to my knowledge, I mean, there isn't really precedent on this, even though in American history, I mean, we've had, you know, a few other scenarios where we've questioned, you know, the validity of some executive orders and pardons and other things, but not for substantially the precisely same reason. So what would be the landscape in terms of perhaps avoiding these kinds of contests in the future? Because so much, at least in the court of public opinion, has wanted some kind of cognitive test during Biden's presidency, when it was very clear to just the average person looking at Joe Biden that he's not all there. And we all knew it. And yet the media kept telling us, oh, you know, don't believe, you know, your own eyes. And yet there was nothing that was done during Biden's presidency. Now it's only after the fact.
Well, his cabinet should be censured. At the end of the day, the drafters and ratifiers of the 25th Amendment created a safety valve for precisely this type of scenario where the president is operating under a disability that eliminates his ability or precludes his ability to carry out his constitutional duties and responsibilities. And the cabinet had a responsibility to act on that. And certainly the Department of Justice, Merrick Garland, Biden's attorney general, his organization had identified that the president couldn't form the requisite mental state to commit an intentional act. Well, that then triggers the 25th Amendment, and his cabinet had a responsibility to act. They should all be sanctioned, censured, and investigated for that.
Wow. And what about potentially criminal liability? I mean, these are things that... you know, if they knew and they were willing to put these documents in front of him, I mean, and perpetuated a fraud on the American people, I mean, there are potentially criminal statutes as well.
Absolutely. Fraudulent behavior, forging documents, authenticating documents that are that, you know, purport to have an authenticity they don't actually have. And again, it's a fraud of constitutional proportion. That's why those wrongdoers need to be held accountable.
And then last question for you, and I know that that you need to run here, Attorney General Andrew Bailey. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you this morning. So where should Pam Bondi go from here with something like this? I mean, the Inspector General investigates, but in terms of the USAG and her overall role and scope, I mean, we've heard so much about, you know, the Epstein files, some of these other things, but in my view, this is even dramatically more important.
Well, and I think that I have a lot of faith and confidence. I fully trust that Attorney General Pam Bondi will do the right thing. And look, the Inspector General has a process. That process is governed by regulations at the Department of Justice, and I'm certain that it'll be taken seriously, and it'll be put through the process, and the Inspector General will ultimately likely make a recommendation to General Bondi. But I have full faith and confidence in General Bondi and her Department of Justice. Boy, what a different world we wake up in March of 2025 than in a year ago in March of 2024, when the President Biden had been declared by his own Department of Justice to be incompetent, and yet no one did anything except serve up legal documents to affix the president's signature to in a fraud on the American people.
Wow. I mean, this is so well said, and this is why elections have consequences and why we all need to engage in our civil government process and really hold we the people very seriously, that we hold the keys to our government offices, and no one in this country is entitled by heritage, conquest, or otherwise to public office. They truly need to serve. So Attorney General Andrew Bailey, thank you for serving the people of Missouri and conservative principles overall, and we'll really look forward to following up on both this request to the US DOJ as well as the massive win against the Chinese Communist Party. So you can follow Attorney General Andrew Bailey at AG Andrew Bailey on X. And, you know, this is why, as I've been saying again and again, this is why leading up to the midterms, all of these things matter, and why we need to continue to encourage all conservatives to get out and vote and ensure that we can have a substantial conservative margin that is filibuster proof in the Senate, and make sure, and this isn't just, you know, the Republicans versus Democrats, because Rhino Republicans are sometimes just as ineffective or worse than some Democrats. So this is about getting the right people in office to advance not only Trump's mandate and his agenda, but also on the state level as well. I mean, if the people of Missouri didn't have all of their elections and they didn't support people like Andrew Bailey, and like here in the state of Florida, Governor DeSantis and others, then we wouldn't have such conservative wins. So be engaged, and you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.